This week, 25 years of the Porsche GT1 with Tony Hatter and Mark Sumter.
Brought to you by Nineworks.co.uk, the fastest growing online Porsche community, supported by the Nineworks Marketplace. Nineworks Radio is your dedicated Porsche and car podcast, hosted by Lee Sibley, Andy Brooks, and Max Newman. Nineworks Radio is carefully produced with special input from experts around the industry and powered by our valued members of the Nineworks Driven Not Hidden Collective.
Good day, Mr. Max Newman. How the devil are you?
Good day. We're getting there. At least the sun's out, eh?
It is. That is nice. It's gorgeous.
Very, very nice. It's already like being in California.
We're down on Mr. Sibley today. He is on his way to Norway. I think he might even be on a channel tunnel as we speak.
I think he probably is, yeah. Under the sea.
Indeed, yeah. Myself and Lee spoke to our guests today. So Lee will be making an appearance later in the episode. But yeah, it's just me and Max for now. It was great to catch up with Tony Hatter and Mark Sumter on the subject of the GT1, which I don't really know much about, I must say. Sort of looked on from afar. You must have more experience, obviously, Max. You're much more into that sort of side of things.
Well, no, actually, era wasn't really my era. By the time that we were into that category of racing, I was quite heavily involved in motorbike racing. I was distracted. After the demise of Group C, that then coincided with me going off in a slightly different direction. So I only saw it from afar.
Yes.
Which is a bit of a shame because it's after Group C, or someone would say probably more, one of the classic eras of sports car racing.
Yeah, flippers. I think you'd call it.
So.
Oh, well, you're in for a learning as well then, because I was when we spoke to the guys the other day. Lots of interesting information about that car. I didn't realise how different the three cars were. Well, the first and the second one, the
96
and 97 are pretty closely related,
yeah,
but look quite different. And then the third one, the 98, is like just a totally different car. Like, yeah, they might as well be called something totally different. They're just not the same. So yeah, it's really interesting to hear them.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I had got lots of sort of some questions and thoughts in mind about that evolution, because there does seem to be that big change. So yeah. I'm really looking forward to, I was looking forward to asking that. So I'm looking forward to hearing about that when I get
it's
to.
Yeah, shame you couldn't make it.
Gutted. I love Tony and Mark. Fascinating people, both of them. So it's going to be a great listen, I'm sure.
Right. I think before we get on to GT1 stuff with Tony and Mark, Lee had a little session with Leon at Charade to talk about their new outfit in Bristol.
They've expanded from the Midlands into the Southwest.
Yes, brilliant. Indeed. Yeah, I think that's all open and up and running and tickety-boo now. And Lee had a little chat with Leon to see how things are going. So we'll give that a play now.
Excellent.
Leon Coupland from Charade UK, thanks for joining us on Nineworks Radio. It's lovely to see you, mate.
And you. It's been a long time.
It has been a long time. It's been a very long time. So, last time I saw you, I think it was on the Nineworks Awards last year up at what is now Charade HQ at Cannock.
At Cannock, yes. Yes, so, that was great evening. Really good evening.
It was great fun. So, obviously, there's been a lot of work behind the scenes at Charade in the interim. Yep. So, and that's kind of why I led to Cannock now being referred to as HQ, because the company has expanded and I'm chatting to you up in Bristol, I think you are.
Yes, I'm at the, newly created Bristol site. It's literally just over 12 months old now. We've gone through a major transformation of an already established repairer in Bristol. and we've turned it into one of the new Charade UK sites.
Fantastic.
We're very fortunate. We've already achieved Porsche recommendation, and we've got Tesla approval in here as well. Purely focusing on the two brands. We're nearly over the line. We've done this in a very organic way rather than hell for leather right from the outset. We want to make sure that we're established. So we have one major item to complete before we're fully functional. But apart from that, we are open. We are operational now. We're just waiting for the new workshop floor to be painted. And we will be inviting people to come and have a look.
Yes, it'd be lovely to do an event over at Charade Bristol and get people through the door and to take a look.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that. Yeah.
I know Steve is particularly passionate about Porsche, like obviously racing them. He's managed to acquire a lovely 993 Carrera this year, so I'm hoping we can do something with that shortly. So personally and kind of professionally for you guys as a business, Porsche means a lot to you. So I assume it's kind of crucial, therefore, to have acquired that Porsche recommended status that you have for Bristol as well as Cannock.
Yes. I mean, the Bristol site originally come about just before lockdown, which was, 2020,
yeah.
Where we had a meeting with Porsche GB, and they said that there was an area of concern for them, which was the Bristol and surrounding areas. And would we like to tender for the recommended partnership, which we did. And then obviously lockdown put everything on ice. And we come through that. We actually won our tender. Porsche recommendation in Bristol was what it was all about. It was location was paramount to us. We had to be within, good reach and sensible reach of many of the OPCs that we're dealing with. So, although Bristol OPC is our closest one, they've obviously got their own internal body shop as well. But we also deal with Tewkesbury OPC and Cardiff OPC. And recently we started dealing with Exeter as well. So we've actually got four dealerships that we are in conversations with. I won't say daily, but certainly going forward, we're building that relationship.
Yeah.
GB's stance to us was to cover or supply a solution for these guys, and that's exactly what we've done. And Bristol, believe it or not, is right in the middle of that. So it's about an hour to Cardiff, 47 minutes, I think it is. Tewkesbury's about the same, and Exeter's about an hour and 4 minutes or something daft like that on Google. So we're there for these people if they need us. But more importantly, Charade Bristol is the first recommended Porsche repairer that the Bristol and surrounding areas have had now for 11 years.
Wowzers, okay. Didn't know that.
So, it's quite a big statement to come into this area and do this. But the growth of Porsche in this area has been phenomenal for them. And fortunately, we're here. We are here. We're also, because of the way that the three of us operate, we are growing. We want to expand. We want to keep this going. And yes, we'd love to have Porsche recommendation in the future, two or three or four or five new Charade UKs that will be, big news as soon as we're there to announce it. But there's certainly lots going on behind the scenes, as you can imagine. And it's all predominantly based around the Porsche world.
Yeah, fantastic. We'll look forward to that because we love what you guys have, what you do, and having seen it firsthand up at Charade, I was blown away by that at Cannock. So if you're replicating that for the people of Bristol and the surrounding areas, then that's absolutely fantastic. I'd be keen to know what it takes really to have that kind of Porsche recommended status. I mean, it's not just a case of they give you that tag forever. Like there's constant checks involved in that to ensure certain standards are being met.
Yeah, there is. The standards are probably industry leading by a long way because the tooling requirement. So we have to have exactly the same tooling as the OPCs. So every tool you'll see in their workshops, we've got it here as well. far short of key coding, I believe there's nothing we can't do. So the investment, that leads on to the investment, which is quite a major factor. but even once you've done that, we will still get spot audits maybe 3-4 times a year where they will come in and they will make sure that we're carrying out repairs to exacting methods. As we all know, some of these newer vehicles are built like aircraft. So we have to repair them like aircraft in state-of-the-art cabins for the bonding agents. Our guys have had to go on structural courses that are European standards. They are very, very intense. Our panel beaters are scared to death of the actual course because of the rumours, but it's 5 days of intense 12-hour days, and every Porsche recommended repairer in the UK have to go through it. But it gives them this wonderful certification to say that we can actually bond structural adhesive on these vehicles, which is quite a big thing. Quite a big thing. You know, everyone thinks, oh, it's only a bit of glue. It turns out it's not just a bit of glue. It's a very, very, very technical procedure. And I've been blown away, and along with Steve and our ops director, Brian, we're just absolutely blown away that, you know, what used to be a simple process is no longer. It is extremely technical, extremely technical.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're monitored by Porsche GB on a regular basis. These standards, you have to uphold them. You must have trained technicians. You must have your own personal standards as well. You know, Charade, it has got high standards to start with. So we're quite fortunate with the way that we present the business. However, you've got to have, you know, you've got to have, perfection's a strong word. And I don't think perfection is absolutely possible all the time. You know, we are just trying to rebuild vehicles that are built by billions of pounds of robots. We're very, very good at it. However, perfection is a strong word, a very strong word. I'd like to think we do the very best possible. And, hey, no doubt so do all the other recommended repairers as well. We're all in the same boat. I think currently there's only 17 in the UK. There's a good reason why there's only 17. It's not that easy.
Yeah.
It's not as easy as what everyone thinks.
I remember being at Charade Cannock at the start of the year, and one of the guys there in the workshop was talking us through the process to recalibrate a Taycan to get it back on the road. And it is unbelievable. I'd love to do a video on it. It might be a bit spotty, but I just think that people have got to see this. Like what you have to go through to get one of those like recalibrated is kind of ludicrous, really. And again, you need all the correct like tooling in order to do that. But it's
exhausting,
to say the least.
Well, I think it's credit to our teams around us, and you know, I've always been a huge team person. That the guys and the girls that are working on these vehicles, the knowledge they now have to get embedded into them is absolutely phenomenal. And this was one of the reasons why we said at Bristol we're only going to go with two manufacturer approvals, because we are manufacturer approval people. That's what we do. Whereas, you know, in prior lives and to be fair, Cannock used to as well, but we started depleting the manufacturer approvals so that we can get focused on the one or two. And the reason is that, to recalibrate a Taycan is one hell of a job. If you then got to replicate that on five different brands, it becomes diluted.
Yeah.
It does become diluted. So our focus is more about being absolutely niche on one or two items. And by doing that, we believe that, you know, our guys are going to be very, very similar to the OPC technicians. Very similar. Yeah, we don't do servicing. Of course we don't. That's not our thing. But they're going to be working on Porsches 9 hours a day, 45 hours a week. Hopefully I'll get them in for a bit of overtime as well. but they become focused on, as you do with your Porsche world. You know all about that side of it. That's what we want our technicians and our front of house people and all the other team members that, you know, take it. It will take a huge part in achieving what we've done so far.
Yeah, fantastic. Absolutely fantastic, Leon. I need to ask you how big the site is at Bristol in comparison to Cannock, because Cannock is sizable.
Yeah. So Bristol is, I think if I remember rightly, it's about 12,000 square feet on the shop floor. So comparing it to Cannock, the main building at Cannock, I'm pretty sure is about 20,000 square feet. So it's a little bit smaller. I think if we look at that or break that down a little bit, Cannock still has and will keep numerous manufacturer approvals there. Where we'd like to think we're going to be in the very near future is Bristol will have a workshop that only has Porsche.
Yeah.
It will always have Tesla because there's Tesla everywhere. But it's all about Porsche for us. So if I walked to the workshop today, I'd probably find 10, maybe 12 vehicles there. And because we've built it with Porsche paramount to this, there's only about 12 bays out there. So our bays are very, very big compared to an everyday workshop. And I think you'll start seeing that with some of the other new recommended repairers that are building at the moment. There's currently one a little bit further up Manchester way. And they're going through this as well. You know, we have for the electric vehicles, we have to have some, you know, some big safety standards achieved. We must have great big working bays.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're 8 meters by 5 meters. In an everyday body shop, you could probably get 2, maybe 3 cars in that space. But no, we've insisted we have them. We have 2 of these bays, and they're big. They're as big as the ovens.
Yeah, Christ.
Yeah, so it's a lot more. You can't really compare it with Cannock on the grounds that Cannock was built 15, 20 years ago now. And standards weren't that great at Porsche GB at the time, i.e. electric vehicles probably weren't even heard of when we started, other than milk floats.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day when it was designed. But, yeah, the world's evolving, isn't it, around the electric market, whether we like it or not.
Yeah.
And until they put sound boxes outside so they sound like real cars, I don't think anyone's going to like them.
Yeah. Agreed. Well, that's fantastic, Leon. It's great to hear that the Charade empire is expanding outside of the Midlands at Cannock and is now down in Bristol there. So
And more to come.
Well, we look forward to it. Yeah. So it's not just repair, but restoration as well and kind of everything in between. So,
yeah, lots of things going on in the future.
Amazing. We'll look forward to the development at Charade. Leon, cheers for joining us on Unmatched Radio.
No, thank you very much.
Oh, great to hear from Leon there. Good to hear it's all going well in Bristol.
Yeah. Looking forward to opportunity to go and check that out, perhaps.
Yeah, I think there might be an opportunity to do some sort of event up there at some point in the future. So that'd be cool. I quite fancy actually a weekend in Bristol. I haven't been up there for years, and I know it's like, I don't want to call it a hip little town, but you know, it's quite a cool little town. I think it's got a good vibe going on.
I think it is a hip little town, or a hip city, of course. Apologies to Bristolians out there. I'm a big fan of Bristol. I go there fairly often because Mandy is a Bristolian.
Oh, is she?
And her mum and dad and sister all still live in and around Bristol, so I'm there often. A big fan. Big fan.
Okay, good. Well, let's make sure that happens then.
Absolutely.
I reckon it's probably 20 years since I've been to Bristol. That's
scary, really?
Isn't it? Yeah, that's crazy.
It'll have come a long way since then. There's some great restaurants, bars, coffee shops.
Awesome.
There's even some decent car spotting.
Is there?
Yeah. Right. You see some nice, some interesting stuff around there. Yeah, great city.
Good. Okay. All right. Let's do that then. Right. Let's get back to GT1s, shall we? You're gagging to hear the guys, I believe.
Yeah, really interested. Not an era of GT racing that I actually know very much about. So I sort of observed it from afar. I was off doing other things during that, you know, post Group C era. So yeah. I was gutted not to be able to make that record with Tony and Mark. I had lots of things in mind, lots of, you know, about the evolution of that car over the 3 years that it raced. So I'm looking forward to hearing what information you got out of them.
Yeah, well, I hope we came up with the right questions for you, Max.
I'm sure.
Yeah, no, it was good. It was good. It was great to hear like Tony's experience. And there's some really interesting little snippets as well. Things like the windscreen. I'm letting it all out of the bag. Let's play it. Otherwise, I'll be letting all the snippets away.
Have a listen. I can't wait to hear some of Tony's got. He's a great storyteller, isn't he?
He is.
I know there's going to be some great anecdotes and tales of actually being on the ground at Le Mans with the cars, as well as all the design and the evolution of that.
Yeah. It really showed how small the company was back then.
Yeah.
Multifaceted job titles, I think it's probably the way to put it.
Yeah, so that'd be interesting. And to hear what Mark's laconic descriptions of what these things are like to drive are so interesting, because he's so talented. He makes it all sound very easy. Driving these things. But interested to hear what he says about that.
Absolutely. Cool. Let's play it.
Okay.
Mr. Tony Hatter, legendary Tony Hatter, of course. It's fantastic to have you on our
Less of the legend, please.
You said that last time as well. And then equally legendary, certainly in our estimations on Nine Works Radio, is Mr. Mark Sumpter from Paris.
Bring it on. I like the legend.
Lap it up, Mark.
Do I get a call as well?
A used car dealer from Five Ashes gets called a legend. I'll take it.
Perhaps he does for the wrong reason, but anyway.
Look, thanks for joining Andy and I and everybody else listening today. So we're primarily celebrating the 25th anniversary of the GT198 victory at Le Mans. But we want to turn this into a bit of a GT1 special. And so it's great to have Tony along as the designer of that car. And then Mark as a massive enthusiast of, I think, fair to say, race cars of that era, with particular reference to the GT1, having owned one and driven one, raced one yourself.
Not race, but yeah, definitely driven, and you know, at high speed on track days and high speed demonstrations and things. Yeah,
amazing. Well, it's still an experience that not too many of us mortals on planet Earth have had to experience. So yeah, we're looking forward to diving into this. I guess Tony, particularly, I know you were there at Le Mans in 1998, and we'll dive into your role on the day since, but. Can you believe it's been 25 years, really?
It's hard. I haven't been back to Le Mans for 25 years, to tell you the truth. I'm going there next week.
Yeah.
The 356 SL, with Cameron Healey's car, for a few days. We're driving the old route that the SL would have taken in 1951. So no auto routes. We're taking the old routes. It's on a trailer, but I'm going with Cameron Healey. So I'm going back to Le Mans for the first time.
Wow. So you've not been back since 1998?
No, because Porsche then pulled out, so I wasn't involved. And when they eventually did get back into the main class, Starling wasn't involved anymore in the cars. So.
Yeah. I still think they should have like a Legends Lounge. I previously mentioned on the podcast about how Richard Attwood often goes to Le Mans with Audi. And I asked him why, and he said, well, because Porsche don't invite me. And this is the guy that, you know, gave Porsche its first win at Le Sard. So,
yeah.
Very bizarre. So, yes, let's kind of start with GT1 Genesis. So I think we should outline for people, there was the GT1 in 96, the GT1 Evo in 97, and the GT1 98 in 1998. And those cars had kind of various differences.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure we'll discuss. So, Tony, from the outset, when did you kind of jump on board the GT1 project in reference to its design?
Well, it happened before the summer break in 95. Hamlet Guy was my boss, and he said, you're going to get a phone call from a guy from the racing department because they want to do something. And so I think I went on holiday for 2 weeks, but showing up July or August, I'm not sure when, we had the phone conversation, and it was Dieter Steinhauser, who was then the body specialist for the racing cars, and outlined what they wanted to do. And there was still a lot of old school stuff happening. And I was given a package of the vehicle, packages, the wheels, the engine, where the guy sits, a center line, and a couple of sections to the front and rear of the car. And I was given this as data. Now, the racing department hadn't built cars with data up until that point. At least I don't think so. We just finished the 993, of course, and we did that. We modeled that in clay. It was then scanned, and then an external firm called ADAG in Fulda surfaced the bodywork. For the first time, we did surfacing on a computer. So that was computer-aided design, CAD. But there was still no computer-aided styling. In those years between 993 and the GT1 in 95, I'd been experimenting with one or two other people in the company of a designer actually sitting at a computer and making surfaces. And so this was the idea. We can give this poor guy the job of building a car in zero time, because, you know, you have no time for these projects. And the car. And so I got the package, I got the computer, I got this huge workstation underneath the desk, and this very, very delicate software called CDRS, Computer Aided Design and Rendering System. And if you make a surface in that system, there's so much data that if you just sneeze, the thing will just crash. So it was a very, very difficult baptism of building a car with that system. But that was because I could do it quickly. We could get some results quickly. We could then mill a wind tunnel model, a scale model, very quickly, and that gave Norbert Singer something to do quite quickly on in the project.
Right. Okay. So it was from that initial GT1 then in 1996 that you were responsible for. So were you equally responsible as like the appearance of that GT1 changed in the two subsequent years?
Absolutely. So that model, we did mill it in clay, and most of it stayed. Norbert Singer then took that thing into the wind tunnel, and I worked with him. And then we modified the scale model in the wind tunnel, and then went back to the studio and we milled in full size in clay GT1s, which weighed about 2.5 tons of, it was just an incredible model. We could hardly move it because it had no ground clearance. It was something we hadn't really done before. So that model we then used the next year too for the Evo. So we already had the model, so we just used that model to model in clay again. The evolution of the GT1 97 was the Evo. And then, of course, 98 was a different car altogether. That was a monocoque. And we did that only in a computer. We didn't do any modeling. There was a model milled for the wind tunnel, but everything was done online, digitally.
Digitally, yeah.
Digitally, not online, yeah.
What are the main differences in designing a race car compared to a production car then? I imagine time is a key factor.
Time, because Le Mans starts at 4 o'clock in the Saturday afternoon on June, whenever it is. So there's no, in a project that we did, like let's take a new 996. Okay, the car's going to come out in 3 or 4 years' time. We've got this amount of time. We have to get the body done by about here. Oh, we've got problems. Okay, things happen. But with a race car, there's a timeline, and you can't change it. Things have to be finished. So that was the main difference. And then, of course, because you've got a short amount of time, there are less meetings, there are less people higher up in your department who are coming to tell you what to do or what not to do or what they think. So it was pretty much you can't do a series production car like that. You can't. But that's what happened.
Yeah, I assume there was less input from marketing, surely, because a race car is serving a very different purpose.
They had nothing to do with it.
Dream.
I bet that was refreshing.
Yes.
How much of the first car has got 993 actually in it?
Well, I've got the model. I don't know if you can see it. So yeah. The cockpit, I don't. There are. If you took all the bodywork off, you'd see a 993 or let's say 911 body. You'd see the this bit. So from here to here is 9 and 3, and the crash structure and everything is 9 and 3 as well. It's not carbon fiber, it's a steel steel crash structure.
Okay, so there's actually a fair amount of 9 and 3 in the original there.
Even the door section is 9 and 3. Door handles 9 and 3.
I didn't realize that so much of it was so closely related to 9.
And then we took the Speedster, the 964 Speedster windscreen, because making a windscreen is also a difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
In the end, and they said you can't change that, so that's why you have this funny condition here. That's the Speedster. Can you see that?
Oh yeah, you've got a little shape.
It's a difficult area to resolve because it was a Speedster, and the Speedster doesn't have a roof.
Yeah.
So that became a bit strange. Then they said, oh, we've got to cut out the windscreen to get enough air through this roof-mounted air intake. Oh, we're making a new windscreen.
So that was after
everything else had been finished. So,
so you had all of those constraints for a Speedster windscreen and then in the end had to throw it away. Brilliant. Was there any other bits like that that were from bits of
from other cars? Probably are. Of course, you've got 9 and 3 headlights.
Yeah.
We got away with doing smaller blinkers, smaller indicators. But that's about it, I guess.
9 and 3 style. Are they 9 and 3 rear lights as well, aren't they?
Yes, of course. Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Because the car's much wider, we had to have some spaces in between the middle bit and the actual tail lights.
Yeah. Yeah, amazing how much actual 993 is in that first car then.
Yeah.
And I'm reading that the engine was mid-mounted and turned 180 degrees.
Yeah.
What kind of necessitated that? Was that just easier access?
Well, that's, as I said, that's the package I got. And the guy who drew the initial package was Horst Reiter, who'd done the 956 and the 962. And probably earlier cars too. He's passed on, but and he retired, I think, after the GT196. I think he retired.
Yeah.
So it's an old school car underneath still.
How important was it, Tony, for Porsche to return to the top level at Le Mans as it was at the time? It was in the BPR series, I think, wasn't it, Mark?
Yes, yeah, FIA, BPR. 96 was just two factory cars, and then customer cars were sold in 97.
How important that was, it's hard for me to gauge. I guess it was very important. And we always thought it was terribly important. But you'd have to probably ask Dr. Wiedeking or somebody like that.
I don't know if you know, Lee, but in 1995, three cars were built as GT1 911s by Porsche on the GT2 chassis. So, three cars were built. Only two raced at Le Mans that year, but they raced in the GT1 class. So they were like a GT2 Evo before the Evo had sort of come out, if you like. It had a higher wing.
Yeah.
It had no air restrictors on the engine. So they had a lot more horsepower. They actually had too much horsepower for the engines because most of them didn't make the 24-hour, you know, when I say most, I don't think that either of the two cars that entered Le Mans finished. So, but there were obviously teams out there that wanted to race Porsche in the GT1 class, but that was the best Porsche could do for 95 was just to build them an unrestricted sort of faster version of the GT2 car and run it in the GT1 class.
I didn't know that then. So I think I've seen about the GT2 Evo as a road car, but do you remember like what the power figure was for the race? Was it
600 horsepower?
Right, okay, yeah.
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 Yeah, yeah, which was quite a lot for an air-cooled engine. I think they realized that was sort of beyond a sort of safe level to run that engine. Hence that when the GT1 came out, it was water-cooled.
Yeah. Yeah. How, like, for you guys at the time, how exciting was it from, like, a spectator point of view? Obviously, we've just had, like, the demise of Group C at the start of the 1990s, really. And then, I mean, in this day and age, the GT1 cars are looked back on so fondly, like in terms of how they look, they've just got such presence, you know, not just Porsche, but McLaren as well, and Toyota, or was Mercedes, isn't it? They're just like amazing cars to look at. But what was it like seeing them race at the time?
Well, it was fantastic. I was there in 87, I think, when Jaguar won, and just narrowly beating the 962s. And it was just absolutely awesome seeing those cars. And then in those days, I don't think they had the kink in the Le Mans straight. And there was still the restaurant where you could go there and have steak and chips and just about sit on the straw bales as these things came past you. 200 miles an hour. That was just fantastic those days.
Ludicrous, utterly, yeah. Utterly.
And at night, watching the going around the corner, the Mulsanne corner, with the brake discs glowing red, and just incredible. Those days were fantastic.
So we'll go from. I'd like to build up to 98 and that victory, the 16th overall on the. Porsche's 50th birthday. So again, like a kind of similar to this year where Porsche was 75, yeah. And there's kind of a lot of pressure to deliver a success there. It was definitely the same in 1998. But obviously with 97, there were some key changes to the GT1 at that point. And Mark,
they made it ugly.
No.
The jury's out on that.
Sorry. I just had to put that in there.
Well, I'll let you and Mark fight that out there, because that's Mark, yours was the GT1 Evo, so it was a 97 spec
year. Yeah, well, strange. So the factory for 96 obviously ran the 993 shaped cars, the pair of factory cars. And then for 97, the factory cars were Evos, but the customer cars were all born as 993 shaped cars.
Okay.
So the nine customer cars, mine being the ninth car, was delivered end of April 97 as a 993 shaped car. Mine was sold to Franz Conrad, and he did a race, and then I think he did one race and then Le Mans in it as a 993 shaped car. They weren't, you know, they weren't as competitive as they thought they hoped they were going to be. So I think he did a couple of other races in it and then sent it back to the factory with most of the other teams. I think out of the nine cars, I think five of them within a few months were back at the factory being evolutionized.
Wow.
And although they then looked like, I mean, obviously Tony will know the details of this, but although people sort of say, oh, it's a 996 GT1. It's the same car. So the inner wings, it's all 993.
Yeah.
So obviously they widened the cars, and it made sense when they widened the cars, I guess, to start to use the later headlights and things. So, but the actual car, if you look under, you know, it's changeable parts. It's all body parts and really expensive body parts. There was an engine upgrade, but basically a wider track, and wider body work. And I guess because they didn't have, I mean, again, Tony will know, but I don't think they had as much downforce as people were expecting. They were a very fast car at the end of the straights, but definitely compared to a Group C car, they had very little downforce.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the widths. I don't know if you can see in this model, this car has wheel lips.
Yes.
Yeah. We didn't model wheel lips on the car. They came at a very, very late stage when the car was basically finished, and somebody realized that the track or the bodywork wasn't covering the wheel. I cannot remember what happened. So then we had to model wheel arch extensions on the 96 car, which is unbelievable. That's why the 97 car, then we were able to then model the fenders properly without having any wheel lips. That's why the front is a bit wider. Yeah. I don't think, Mark, that the track changed. You might be right. I don't think it did.
Okay.
It's just that the wheel arch extensions on a race car is just ridiculous, and we did that.
And then the front lip, the front spoiler was quite pronounced on the Evolution, wasn't it? It came out quite a bit further.
Yeah. Then the front. So now we get to the 97 car. Incidentally, the 96 car we did with Zach Speed. They were our partners in just on the Rhine, just towards near Bonn, between Bonn and Cologne, somewhere up there. Zaxby did the bodywork for us.
Oh, yeah. Really?
This car was done by Lola Composites. So I spent some time in Huntingdon, where we still wanted to make the car look good. So there was a lot of servicing and service problems to be sorted out with this car. We did it with Lola Composites. Yeah, and so this, the width here is now the proper width. And we came up with the idea of getting the air out of the wheel arch.
I think that was more successful, wasn't it? Getting the air out of the wheel arch to stop lift, because they obviously struggling with lift, weren't they? All of these GT1s, not only Porsches, but all of them were struggling. You know, some dramatic video of them doing big wheelies and sometimes flipping over.
I know. Yeah. So the 96 car, even though it came out in 96, was based on 993, but the 996 had come out, or was coming out was already out. And it was a bit silly doing a car based on a 993 when the 996 was the flavor of the month. So this car then had to sort of look like a 996. So that's why it has 996 headlights and the treatment of the front air opening. So that's the story behind that. And of course, we used the same headlights on the 98 car, which was also a bit, you know, stupid when you think about it, but that's what we did.
It wasn't just the headlights, it was the rear lamps as well were 996.
Well, yeah, and bury the rear lights within the bodywork somewhere, yeah. And of course, they're type approved, you know, so there had to be nothing done, or it wasn't cheap. It was the obvious way to go because the car had to be homologated for the road.
Yeah.
And this car, all of them, all three of them, there were road versions, drivable with tests and everything.
Well, the GT198, which we'll come on to, we'll discuss the evolutions, and then, Mark, it would be great to have an understanding of the full history of your car. Of course, you've sold it on
custodian,
but it'd be great to get an understanding of the history of that, and then also from you understand what it's like to drive one of these, because, as I said earlier on, there's not too many people that can tell us that. With the 98, then, as we pointed out, it's a sea change, really, of that car in comparison to the original GT1 and then the GT1 Evo. Of, as you said, you know, carbon monocoque and everything else. So what brought around those changes? Was it born out of regulations or extra cash involved?
The desire to win. Lead the desire to win.
Yeah, right,
that was
okay.
Like the third time, and I know Dr. Wiedeking said this car has to win them all.
Yeah,
and the only way to do that was to raise the game and make a proper race car.
I think that I mean, I don't know because I wasn't any part of it at all. But when you look at the first iteration, it was very correct as a homologated road car, and it was very, very correct. And then when you looked at the other manufacturers that came into it, like Mercedes, they basically built a, you know, they'd come at it from a different angle. I think they'd come at it from, let's build a race car and we make one road legal version of it.
I think
that once Porsche and other manufacturers had seen, and Mercedes were completely dominant, you know, in the 97, I think it was in 97, they won most of the races. No, 98, they won most of the races other than Le Mans. And obviously, struggled. But I wonder if, you know, other manufacturers looked at Mercedes and thought, oh, okay, we need to take this to a different level because it's not necessarily sort of flouting the rules, but it's maybe, you know, stretching the rule book a little bit.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't, you know, that they were more race cars that they managed to sort of make a homologation to road legal, but it's very much a stretch of the rules, I think.
Yeah, because GT1, obviously Group C became very, very, very expensive, and the whole kind of point of GT1 was to bring the budgets down for that kind of top level endurance racing. And then as you point out, Mark, I think certain manufacturers flipped that on its head to do a race car that you could almost crowbar onto the road rather than the other way around, as to go racing with road cars.
Yeah, when you consider that, that you know, Porsche, sorry, if you look at the Ferrari F40 was the GT1 version, and that's very much a road car.
Yeah, yeah.
And then obviously McLaren, you know, and they had a great 1995, didn't they, with the F1, which was a road car. But the Mercedes was a different thing altogether.
Yeah, yeah, very much so. So, yeah, I suppose if the likes of Mercedes are raising the game across town then, Tony, then in what was Porsche's 50th birthday at the time in 98, then yes, I can imagine all the stops were put out in order to deliver the victory. Yeah.
I had the honour, because the homologation at Le Mans was always in the city centre on probably the Tuesday before the race. So I had the honour of driving with Bob Wallach in the road-going GT 198 from the track to the centre of town in Le Mans, which is, you know, a half-an-hour trip in the traffic.
Wow.
Again, we had every traffic light, we had to open up the doors because it was terribly. <Okay. laughs> But I'll never forget that. And we got there, and because Porsche thought they had to bring a road-legal car, which is true, but I think Mercedes and Nissan, perhaps Panos brought a car, but they had them on trucks somewhere. And they were just like, yeah, we've done that. Yeah. Oh, yes, it's road legal. But we drove that thing, or Bob Wallach drove that thing to the homologation and back. That was, never forget that.
Very amazing. Cool. Very cool. Yeah. So far as I'm aware, there is only one Stratton version of the 98, and that's the white car that's still in the Porsche Museum collection. Yeah. Wow. So you've driven round Le Mans in that car. That's fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. I think when you can, when you look at the GT 198, and I covered this in a Nineworks TV video when visiting the storage facility at Porsche last year, when you look at that car in comparison to the GT 1 and then the Evo of 97, there are a lot of changes. And like you say, where there's kind of, they've started again from a blank bit of paper, like the bodywork. It kind of, with the older cars, you can see 911 in there underneath. With the GT 198, that you can really see the bodywork just kind of cloaks.
Well, yeah, there's no changes. But it's just a different car.
Yeah,
it's just a different car. It's a complete monocoque. We only made it look like a 911 by giving it this graphic on the side. Otherwise, there's nothing, and the headlights, of course, there's nothing really Porsche like about it. You know, it's a race car.
The 96 and the 97 cars are very closely related, but then the 98 car is a totally different car, isn't it?
Yeah,
probably the only things that are the same are the headlights and the taillights.
And I don't believe they sold any cars to customers. I think that they may have leased some. Did Zach Speed had a pair of green cars, didn't they? Did they run a pair of cars, Tony?
What, 98?
Yeah, there were the works cars, and then there were the green cars with the red and white stripe.
They were 97 cars.
Okay. So they never sold a 98 car to a customer.
No.
Yeah. No. And one of in the Porsche Museum, and again, this is covered on the video. They've had a car that was originally a Zach Speed car. It was crashed in the States, taken back to the factory. And Porsche turned that car into an exact replica of the number 26 Le Mans winning car, which is part of the collection these days. So, Tony, like away from the actual design of the 98, then you were also responsible in the run up to Le Mans for putting the livery on the car.
Well, yeah. Okay, let's go back to the liveries. we always got the rest of the designers involved in doing liveries, and you know, a few sketches. Oh, yeah, that looks great, super. Well, the liveries go over the various panels of the cars. And you can't do a livery on one panel without having it mounted on the car or the start numbers. So everything had to be mounted together. So each car had, I think, three fronts, three doors, three rears, three rocker panels, you know, and we had two cars, so you can imagine the amount of parts. In that same race, Just had the LMP1 cars. Is that the right designation? Mark, the open cars. They had two, and they also had the same livery. So we had four cars.
Oh, and then all the spare bodywork.
And all the spare, it was a nightmare. So I got there 8 days before the start with a team from Becker Design in Germany. And I probably did stick things on myself, but it was coordinating and getting everything right for each panel on those cars. So that was a mammoth task. And parts kept arriving during those 8 days because nothing's really finished till the flag falls, you know. keep going. I think that's like the nighttime front. It's got an extra headlight or an extra spotlight there.
So
many different parts.
Tony, were you responsible for any of the design on the previous cars in terms of like livery on the GT1 and the GT1 Evo?
No. Well, I was, I worked with them and I worked with the designer who did it, but I didn't draw out those deliveries, no.
Okay, yeah, because I'm just thinking, like, Mark, with the car that you had, I mean, that's had a couple, in fact, of, like, iconic liveries on it, really.
Yeah, it had three. I mean, yeah, two iconic ones. It finished as a Sony PlayStation car when, you know, that's the livery I bought it in and ran it, you know, we restored it to this Sony PlayStation. So a black car, you know, which is really iconic. And for a man of my age, it was, you know, that was... It was cars and PlayStation were sort of a big part of my life, really. So,
yeah.
You know, and that was it's really, I liked it as a PlayStation car. The new owners actually changed it to a previous livery, which is also cool, which is the Marlborough livery. So, yeah. It ran in the middle of its life, it was a Marlborough car.
Knife by that car.
Sorry?
Stefan got that car.
No, it's an English guy that's got it. You know, it's an English guy that's got it at the moment, but he's got it back in the Marlborough livery. The first livery was the Franz Conrad's, which is sort of green and blue and white.
Yeah.
So yeah, it ran three liveries. Most of the customers' cars. I mean, it wasn't a long life for them. So mine was released to the first owner to Conrad in end of April, 24th of April, 1997. And it was retired by the end of 1998. So it only did, you know, it only did two seasons of racing with three teams.
Wow. Yeah. Isn't that in complete difference to the 80s race cars, or say the 70s, where you had, you know, a 73 RSR could become a 74 SR.
A rally car
or something. Yeah, you know, and there was such kind of longevity, and it would kind of, they'd get passed around the teams, but by the 90s it was a couple of seasons.
Anyway, here's the story behind this livery. This was done in the early days of Photoshop, so we're still experimenting with. One of the guys in the studio was able to use Photoshop, which we'd never heard of, and if you look at this swirl design. Right, he put the Mobile One logo in the middle, and there are these filters in Photoshop, and you could twist things. So it's just the Mobile One livery twisted and splayed out, and that's the Barsteiner beer symbol. It looks like beer flowing down the back.
Yeah.
and that was it. And I got this printout of this graphic and gave it to the people. Our Becker Design, and they put it on the car, and then they said, "Well, we need the trucks in the same livery. Have you got any pictures of the truck?" I know that's another thing I never forget. When they left for Le Mans in 1996, three trucks on the road out and towards Weissach with these great big waves on the side. It just looked, you know, out of this world. You got close, you can see that it wasn't very well resolved, because I think it just blew up my A4 print that I had. This model is very nice and precise, but the trucks look, when you got those, very strange.
Yeah, pixelated. So that was the original GT1, Tony, was it? Your factory car with the Mobile One livery?
Yeah.
Very cool.
I remember seeing them at Brands Hatch, because obviously back, you know, it's hard to sort of wind your memory back as far as now we see everything, you know, immediately on our phones and,
yeah,
you know, videos and everything else. But back then, that livery, as Tony was saying, was no one had done that. As far as I know, no one had done that. You know, it was all screen cut stickers, yeah, you know, old fashioned stickers and yeah, paint jobs on cars.
Yeah.
So it was completely different at the time. But if you want, you know, I'd seen it in some Porsche magazines, the car. But, you know, the next thing, you know, after looking in a magazine or Autosport or something, you needed to go to the track to actually see the cars. Whereas obviously today, you know, we get high definition video of anything you want to see, haven't you? You know, so I don't know if it definitely imprinted on my brain, you know, I suppose I was always of an age at the time as well, and I was racing a 993 in the Porsche Club Championship. So the whole thing for me was, you know, it's a real important part of my life. Yeah. And I do remember, you know, I never forget seeing the two cars coming out of the pit lane. I was at Paddock Corner and you saw they go over the rise and I saw these two cars and it was quite a shock actually how amazing that they were.
Yeah.
Did you see the Goodwood members meeting? There was a live stream of the Goodwood members meeting this year, and they had the 98 car and the 96 car,
yes,
circulating, yeah, together.
Yeah, fantastic.
Amazing. So we'll go back to June 1998. So you've had to work 8 days prior to the race, Tony, on affixing deliveries to the works cars. As you've kind of told the story a couple of times, but for those that haven't heard, it'd be nice to tell people that you were very much a part of the team during the race.
I was, and it wasn't just me who was working 8 days, the whole team, like nobody slept, or you slept for 4 or 5 hours. It was intense, absolutely intense. But anyway, when the flag fell, the starting flag, I was then in civvies in the pits with a walkie-talkie and pit pass and everything. So I said, I wanted to know. I had to look up and log what Nissan did and what Panos did, whether they changed tyres, whether they changed drivers, fuel, how long. So I was there and I had to collect this information and radio it back to the this unmarked truck around the back of the pits, where the rest of the guys who'd helped me, who'd been designing the GT1 with me over the last year or two, they also had their own jobs. And it was the strategy and making sure that we knew what the other teams were doing at the end. And funnily enough, at the end, everybody else has been kind of dropped out. I think a Nissan was still running or two, and a Panos, unbelievably, was still running. I think it was the Nissan at the end. And so I was still in there doing my job, you know, an hour or two before the end of the race.
Just your luck that your cars hadn't dropped out and you had to stay. You can watch it all, really.
Tony, do you think they knew where you were from and everything else? I mean, did they come out and give you a cup of tea and some biscuits and say that?
You know, look, you wouldn't believe it. There are so many people in the pit standing around watching. You can see. Everybody's watching everybody else.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, you may have just given everyone the information.
It was incredible.
yeah, slightly contrived. So, as we said, it was an important victory. Porsche's 16th overall on its 50th birthday as well. I think it was 2 days short of the company's actual birth date. So, incredibly important.
What achievement?
It's because as we know, there is one solitary car made, and it's the last road-based car to win Le Mans outright, I believe, which, you know, again, there is one car made that kind of gets in the back door, but it's kind of cool to have that title affixed or attached to a 911.
I should think it was a massive relief, wasn't it, Tony, when it won? After, you know, because it was a hard journey for the GT1, wasn't it?
It was. Well, have you done 24-hour races too, Mark?
Yes, yeah.
You know what it's like. It doesn't matter if you win or lose. At the end of 24 hours or the whole week, you just physically, emotionally, you just, that's it, you know.
Yeah, I bet you wish you'd had more energy to go and celebrate, because you want to celebrate, but you're too
knackered. The only time I've ever hugged a wet man, and it was Alan McNish. He was drenched in champagne, and I hugged him. The only time.
I felt sorry, obviously, for Bob Wallet because he'd had, you know, he was so much to do with the whole thing, and he wasn't in the, he was in the wrong car at the end, wasn't he?
Well, yeah.
You know, he wasn't in the winning car, I mean.
And Bob had, if he could have won, it would have been great,
Yeah.
So it's worth pointing out the winning car was the three drivers, Alan McNish, Stefan Ortelli, and Laurent Aiello, that took that victory, and it was a Porsche 1-2. Is it fair to say it was kind of a typical Le Mans and in a way typical Porsche, a bit of a game of attrition? Because I've read that the GT1s, they weren't the fastest cars there, but it was just as other cars have dropped out.
It was terrible attrition because and both our cars suffered as well. Both of them were in the pits, in the garages, behind the closed doors, having problems sorted out with cooling. And that was incredibly intense. Both cars, mechanics racing around. The problem with these cars were that they had one-piece floors, and getting this floor off and then getting to the rest of the components was terrible. And both cars were half dismantled in the garages about 4 a.m, frantically being worked on.
So how long were they not in the race for? Half an hour? An hour?
Over half an hour, I'd say.
Wow.
It was just intense.
Yeah. Do you have an abiding memory of Le Mans 98, Tony?
It is that. It would be that. Yeah. Seeing that happening in the pits and not believing that it could, you know, there was a success coming. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah. And were you aware, was anybody else aware at the company that would actually turn out to be Porsche's last overall victory at Le Mans for, you know, the best part of 20 years?
Not at all. Not at all. No.
Yeah. So how did that come about then with kind of Porsche moving away from top level?
Dr. Wiedeke had threatened anyway. He said, you've got to win. And it wasn't that Dr. Wiedeke was tight with money. I think we have a lot to thank him for. But I think it's down to the board of directors and their decision. We've won them all. What can we do now? I don't think the carry-on would have been...
I suppose particularly with like the finances of the company at the time, which were documented, and we all know how expensive racing was. So we'd have to wait a number of years for Wolfgang Hatz to come along with the LMP1 project to rectify Porsche's reputation. But, I mean, of course, in the meantime, Mark, your experience has just been, well, outrageous, really, in managing to get your hands on a GT1 and say you're an owner. So could you talk us through how that happened? Like, when did you first, you know, do you wake up one morning and go, I'd really like a GT1 with a PlayStation livery? You know, how did it work?
No, I mean, I'm not really a collector. I like using cars, you know, definitely like driving them. So I've always been club racing and things like that. And it was weird with the GT1 because, unlike, as you touched on earlier, unlike most 911s, when they finish their professional career, they tend to sort of get sold into club races and things like that. But I think because it was quite an expensive car to run, quite a complex car to run, it didn't, with the GT1s, they didn't really do that. They sort of, when they retired them, they just sort of sat in different collections and you didn't see one at a club event or something, you know, racing or doing a track day or something. But one of my friends, weirdly, the PlayStation car was advertised in the back of Autosport magazine for months and months with no takers. Because it was not, at that stage, it was 9 years old. So it wasn't an investment. You know, no one saw it as an investment. You couldn't race it in anything. It was probably too expensive to buy and use to do track days and too complex. But luckily for me, a friend and a customer of ours decided that he was ready to buy it and use it for track days. So he went to, it was still in France. It was still at Labre. So we just retired in 98 and then sort of sat there. And he went over and bought the car, didn't really check it all out. And not that they'd sold him something that they knew wasn't ready to use, but it was just an old racing car and it needed, you know, it needed everything recommissioning. And I think he was just a bit naive and he thought he was going to get it back and within a week, you know, change the oils and then be doing RMA days with it. And that's what he tried to do. You know, and I sort of knew, you know, I was excited that he was buying it and just wanted to be a part of his experience. And I went along to a couple of days with him, and he didn't have much success with it, had technical problems with it. And the last technical problem was there was metal in the oil of the, you know, in the, so the engine was rattling and things. So, he decided to sort of cut his losses and just phone me one day. I was actually at Goodwood Festival of Speed. And my mobile went and he was on the phone and said, I know you love the GT1. If you can, you know what I paid for it, et cetera, et cetera. And if you can buy it, would you like to buy it? And this was in 2007. And, a lot of money, but not a lot of money today, if you like. So,
were you drunk at the time? Or?
No, I wasn't. It would have helped my decision. So I said, Jerry, I said, like, I'd love it. You know, I want to buy it. I said, but I haven't got any money. And he said, well, don't worry about that. He said, if you commit to it, we'll make it work. So, managed to give him a small deposit and borrow. This was before the banks had realized that, this was before the big banking recession. So they used to lend money to anyone. So I managed to do a long, one of these sort of long deals with a big balloon payment at the end and bought it. But couldn't, when I bought it, I knew that I couldn't touch it. I didn't have any extra money, and it needed really, when I looked into it, it needed a new engine or the engine recommissioning. And then you looked at the car and you thought, well, it hasn't been touched for nearly 10 years. So we ended up just leaving it until I paid down some of the loan, and then we started to restore it. But I'd owned the car for about 3 years before we actually finished the restoration.
And that was done in-house at Paragon.
We did some of it here, but no, it was too, it needed to come down to too many pieces, and we just haven't got the space. So it went to, I was doing a bit of Group C racing at the time, and I was running with a team called X-Tech Engineering, and they did the restoration for us. The body went off to a body specialist, and they took all of the, it's obviously carbon fiber, and it went to a place called Normandale's, and they scraped all of the old paint off, and they found all three liveries under, so took the black off, and then they phoned me and said, did it used to be a Marlborough car? And I said, yeah. And then a couple of days later, they phoned me and said, was it blue and green? Yeah. And they just kept uncovering all the paint, which is fantastic.
Pictures of that?
Yeah, probably somewhere. Yeah. I mean, I think we have. Yeah. But they took a load of weight off it doing that, because people had just painted over the. Restored it, managed to get all the, get it really liveried up exactly, and including all the Le Mans stickers on the roof and all of the bits and bobs. And I guess I think I probably owned the car for 4 or 5 years before I first drove it. So it's quite, it's quite a long-winded affair. And then when it was done, I bought the car. We had one spare windscreen and a few spare wheels, but we didn't have enough kit to sort of run it seriously. There was nothing really you could race it in. I mean, I think now, I went to Spa 10 days ago, and there was one running in Endurance Racing Legends.
Yeah.
So now there's actually a few places where you could take these cars and run them. But when I had the car, we ran it. We did Silverstone Classic, which was like a high speed demo with a few McLarens and other exotic cars. That was good fun. When we rebuilt it, I managed to squeeze in a passenger seat and just move the battery slightly. So I always, I've taken quite a few people out in passenger laps with it, which has been really big. It's quite an exciting car to sit in, yourself, but, it's a busy car when you drive it, and the brakes, carbon brakes, it's quite a sort of, it's not particularly smooth. It's quite a busy car. The whooshes of the turbo as you accelerate, and the brakes are quite abrupt. So it's a great car for giving fast lap rides to passengers. I think I did about 20, 25 hours of driving in my car. I took it to Paul Ricard. We did the Goodwood. About 4 or 5 years ago, we did a Goodwood day with it, where the Le Mans car, Dario Franchitti, was there in the Le Mans 98 car. So we did that high speed demo. And what else did we do? Did the hill climb at Goodwood for the 70th anniversary. Did that for the weekend. So yeah, I did quite a lot of things with it, and it's been, you know, it was great fun to own it. I owned it for just over 10 years.
Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. There's you mentioned the passenger seat, Mark. I remember at Total 911, we did a lovely feature on the car at Donington. And I don't know if that was the first time you'd driven that car, when you mentioned a couple of moments ago. If it wasn't the first, it was one of those kind of first runs.
And yeah, it was early on, wasn't it? Yeah.
Was. And there's if future publishing will be so kind as to let us put those on Instagram, it'd be worth sharing, because we were able to take that, you know, the body off, and it's a work of art underneath, as far as I'm concerned, just as much as the body itself, you know.
Yeah, so I remember that actually. Yeah, you got some great shots in the pit garages, didn't you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was one of my first assignments on Total 911, I believe. So that would have been end of 2012, maybe start of 2013.
So and did then, we go around the circuit with it then?
So yeah, we revisited it and we did a video. My features editor Josh, he went.
Yes, yeah, I took him around Silverstone in it as well. So
there's a video of that buried on YouTube somewhere, so we'll pull that up.
I felt sorry for him because he had a motorcycle crash helmet, which is obviously a lot heavier than the crash helmet I had on, and I had a hands device.
Yeah.
So when we got to the end of the hangar straight, and you know, I don't know how fast you go, 175 or something, and you hit the brakes and change down three gears for Stowe, you know, it's quite and the in-car thing, his head, he hasn't got any neck muscles.
I remember seeing the video, and you know, Josh has done plenty of racing in his time, being thrown around like a rag doll in there. It's funny to watch. So again, we'll share it because it's great to see these cars.
A couple of years after that, we did Silverstone Classic, and they managed to. So we had 3 half-hour sessions over the weekend of Silverstone Classic as high-speed demos for GT1 cars. And they managed to get it done as a track day license so we could take passengers. So each session I took 3 passengers, and you could just do a sort of, you know, put passenger in, do an out lap, one pass, and then a fast lap in. And some of the friends that I took out had never been on a track before. And their only experience ever of going on a track is these sort of 3 laps in a GT1.
Oh,
I don't think they realised, you know, that how special that is.
Yeah, without a doubt.
I've been in GT1 as a passenger, as I said, with Bob Wallach. But in 96, we had the road car, the two white road cars. I had started a classic car thing in a local town near here called Leo Motor, where all my friends and we'd have this thing on the marketplace in Leonberg. And they let me have the road-going GT1 for the day.
My word.
On a Saturday. So I went to Weissach and picked it up on Saturday morning and drove it there. And it was a nightmare in traffic. But when I look back, I can't believe I even did that. Anyway, the second time.
Amazing.
Then there's the Bob Wallach thing. And then last year, I was Walter Röhrl's co-driver in a road-going 97 car on an event in Bavaria, in the forest of Bavaria. So absolutely incredible, sitting next to Walter Röhrl, and he's thrashing around these country roads in a GT1. And behind me was a Carrera GT and then a 918 Spider, who had the whole Porsche history, traveling to amazing speeds through these small Bavarian lanes. Unbelievable.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Mark, it'd be great to get an understanding really of kind of what it is like to drive these cars. So to kind of paint a picture for people listening at home, 3.2 litre twin turbo flat six, mid-mounted, a weight roughly 1250 kilos. Was that correct for yours? Or
do you know, because we didn't race it, I don't actually, you know, when you race cars, you sort of know, you remember exactly the weights when you put them on the scales and all of that. I don't really know the weight of them, but yeah, it sounds about right.
It will deviate according to competition and whatnot, but 550 horsepower roughly.
I mean, because we knew we weren't racing my car, when we dynoed the engine, we ran it without the restrictors in that it would have raced with. So my car would have had, a little bit more power and quite a lot more torque. We mapped the engine to just run without any air restrictors.
Yeah.
It was fast. You know, it was I'd been racing the Group C car, which is a faster car over a lap, but the GT1 definitely feels, as I say, it feels more sort of urgent, if you like, because it's very, very dramatic car to drive. You know, the way it delivers the power and the noise of the twin turbo as they spool up. And it was busy in the car. It's an H pattern gearbox, 6-speed.
Wow, really? I was going to say
H pattern. So you're using the clutch. The brakes are really firm. You know, you have to, if you want to stop, you've got to press the pedal really hard. There's a lot of pedal pressure needed. And obviously they're carbon. So initially there's not a lot of bite to them. You have to get some heat into them. And it's got nothing like the downforce of a Group C car, which makes it feel obviously a lot more lively because it's quite easy to, especially when you know, for the first few laps until you've got heat into everything, it's quite a task to sort of drive it, to be honest. It's not an easy car. Once it's all warm, once it's warmed up, it's good. They had ABS on them. We never ran the ABS on our car. But, you know, had we been racing it, we would have run it with ABS. But yeah, it's quite a dramatic car. You know, we had quite short gears in it. So it was busy, you know, busy on the gears. A lap of Silverstone, you'd be up and down the box a lot. You know, you'd be using second to sixth gear over the lap. But most of the corners would be a sort of third gear corner. And then all of the straights, you'd be back up into sixth gear. So it was really comfortable, easy enough to get in and out of. Not it hasn't got massively high roll cage to sort of get over. Lots of room in it when you're in it. It's really comfortable. You feel like you're in a 911. The dashboard was 993. You know, you've got the same five cutouts, although you've got a little digital readout as well. But it feels like a 911. Gear stick is slightly elevated, you know, over like a 993, so it's in a nicer position. But plenty of room, even when you've got a passenger in there. It's not claustrophobic. I think the Group C cars have a bit more claustrophobic inside. Really lovely wing mirrors, Tony. If you did those, they're fantastic. Thank you, great wing mirrors on the car.
I've got one in the garage. I should have brought it up.
They're fantastic mirrors. Yeah.
Yeah, they're quite a way away from the driver, aren't they?
Yeah, they are, aren't they? Oh, they are. Proper wing mirrors.
There was nowhere to put them. And we modelled them, and then I modelled these three little like grooves in them. And you find that even on the 98 car, we used the same base but mounted them differently.
Yeah, they're really far forward on the 98 car.
You find these little grooves on the interior door trim.
Yeah.
You find them on a Carrera GT all over the place where there's naked carbon fiber, something that I like to put little details.
Tony's grooves.
Because there's no rear, rear vision, there's no rear view mirror.
Yeah.
No.
I think now, you know, if you're going to race a car like that now, you put a camera system in because you can't see the things that are directly behind you.
Yeah.
Did you look at the online stuff from the Nürburgring 24 hours? And there were some in-car shots, and the drivers, they have a TV screen, and they could see what's happening. It's an incredible system they have.
I think it's a Bosch system, isn't it? Where they have like a radar thing, don't they? And they have warning lights to tell you, you know, if cars are approaching and things.
Wow. Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. Slightly different compared to the GT1. But I love, it's a fantastic description, Mark. I feel like I can sit in that car and understand its layout.
Yeah.
So well done on that.
Yeah. Were the wing mirrors electric, Tony?
No.
They weren't? Okay.
You'd have to get somebody else to move there. You wouldn't be getting out and climbing back in. But I loved your description, Mark, of like how dramatic it is to drive. Because in comparison to Group C cars, and I know you've driven those, Derek Beller said on this podcast before, and I think yourself, Mark, that the Group C car was actually quite easy to drive. Like it was a very agreeable car to drive, and it sounds like the GT1 wasn't quite so, you know, where it's very fast, tendency to lift and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, with the Group C cars, you know, to give you an eye, obviously you've got one less gear, so they're 5-speed gearboxes. But if you go down the hangar straight, in obviously in top gear with a Group C car, and you change down to fourth gear for Stowe, and you had so much aero that that's all you'd need to do. You'd sort of dab the brakes down into fourth gear, and then you'd go through the corner. The GT1, you go down there in sixth gear, you're on the brakes for a bit longer, and you go down three gears for that corner. And then, you know, there's a lot less downforce, because obviously they made the rules were that the car had to have less downforce. It's quite it's a flat bottom car, isn't it, Tony? It's got a big, it hasn't got the Venturis that the Group C had, has it? But it's just a busier time. So there's, you know, if you look at any of the in-car stuff, there's quite a lot of input going on with through the steering wheel, whereas a Group C car, you tend to make one input and the car's got so much grip that you make the apex and you're out the corner before you know it, you know, and it's just different with the GT1. And that was just the experience I had just doing the high-speed demos. I can only imagine what it was like racing.
Is it, do you prefer driving one over the other, Mark? Like, what's your preference?
The GT1's more my era. I mean, I love racing the Group C cars, but I was never, you know, that wasn't something that I ever watched in period. So I think that my heart's with the GT, you know, GT1s and GT2 cars. That was my thing. But yeah, the purity of a Group C car, you know, Group C car to me is it's closer to a Formula car in a way. It's a pure racing car. Whereas the GT cars are exactly, you know, they're a road car, you know, that's on the racetrack. So it's a different formula. But yeah, I mean, my heart would be definitely GT1.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Very, very interesting. Okay, Andy, if you're cool, should we just put a couple of questions to the guys from the works?
Absolutely. Yeah, I was just having a quick look through them.
Not the AI ones.
I'm not going to use the AI ones. That seems wrong. Yeah. I'm not going to do that. Yeah. I think you alluded to it earlier, Tony, but this is a question from Mike Bicknell. Does the Porsche marketing department have any influence on the aesthetic of these cars?
Well, obviously, the number one, or not the one, number one goal, the number one goal was to win Le Mans, but in 1996, it had to look like a 911. That was the brief. So I suppose the board of directors, part of the board of directors is the marketing chief, which was, I think, that was Hans Wiedel in those days. I'm sure that was they said, well, if we're going to do it, if we're going to put a car in the top class, it has to look like a 911. So without knowing for sure what happened, I think it was definitely directed from the marketing department that it had to look like, let's say, look like a Porsche. Couldn't be just a racing car. So, yes.
And Mike's got another question here. He said, how much of a deviation is there between a quarter scale wind tunnel with CAD analysis and full scale wind tunnel testing?
I couldn't put my finger on that. We used third scale. We didn't use quarter, we used third scale. So, you know, that's quite a big model.
Yeah.
And initially that's all we did. I don't think we ever put the full size car. At least we didn't put the clay model in the wind tunnel. They might have put a racing car in there at a later stage, but I don't think there's much difference. And with the 97 car, again, that was just the details were done on a scale model. I don't think we did the wind tunnel either with the full size. The 98 car, the cube, it was computer thermodynamics. A lot of it was computer thermodynamics in those days, basic thermodynamics, and they're pretty accurate. And these days, look at the Formula One teams, they do everything in the computer. So I think a clay model is probably far less accurate than a computer model these days.
I have a question for Tony. So the 98 car, they never sold any to any privateer teams. There were obviously requests for them to try to buy them. Do you know why they decided not to sell any customer cars?
I couldn't answer that.
Okay.
Right. I'm actually going to ask one of the chat GPT questions because it's actually very good. This was posed by Steve Kavanagh, it's Steve's question, shall we? Steve Kavanagh from the works, from one of our works drivers from the the Driven Not Hidden collective. His question was, how do you see the influence of the GT1's design on subsequent Porsche models and the overall evolution of the 911 series?
In the evolution of the 911 series, I would say not much. But if you look at what then we did at the Carrera GT, we were even the same group of engineers that did the Carrera GT. So there's a lot of stuff in there sort of GT1-ish, if you like.
Yeah.
Of the rear spoiler and so on. And it was, I guess, the Carrera GT's culmination of what we learned on the GT1 projects. So it didn't really feed back into 911, but perhaps into the supercars, and then of course the 918.
Of course, yeah.
There's them. It's funny you mentioned that, Tony, especially earlier on with the exterior mirrors on the pre-prod Carrera GT, the Roadster. Those external wing mirrors are very different, and I can almost see in their profile like GT1. I would never have realized that until you kind of pointed that out, but I could see it. But they was on like a twin, like two stalk thing on top. Yeah, I remember seeing pictures of Walter Roll with it. But so I see what you mean, where you've kind of been able to crowbar into that Carrera GT. And as we've discussed on a video, if you walk around that car, there are lots of different bits and pieces from your previous projects into that car, which is really...
And that's what Porsche is all about, evolution. I know I said they didn't feed back into the 911 car line very much, but it's all, and we're a very small group of people, and everything we did, you know, everybody saw what you were doing, and it was evolving various car lines and taking what you could from the other designers and other cars.
Yeah, it's very, very, very interesting. I think that's covered it, unless anyone else has got any questions. Mark, if you've got any more questions, feel free to ask away.
I've got one, if I could. So you just talked about the GT1, the Carrera GT, the 918. Do you know what's coming next, Tony?
You know, I wish I did. I know that it's not, the guys are not sitting around. I've been now retired for 2.5 years.
Yeah.
So I know what's coming next at Roof, but I don't know what's coming next at Porsche. They're being very tight-lipped. There are studies happening, I'm sure, but I don't know. And if I did, I wouldn't be able to tell you. So.
I thought I had to ask the question then.
Yeah. For those listening at home, there's a wry smile on Tony's face right now.
You know, I live in flats, which is just round the back of the test track.
Yeah.
And because I spend a lot of time at home these days, it's fantastic listening to the cars testing. Wow. And they're often testing racing cars. I can hear them. They're probably just GT3 RSRs. I don't know, but I can hear these things testing. I haven't heard one today.
How fantastic is that to have that in your backyard?
They start at 7 in the morning.
You know, rude.
They're not allowed to go over a certain decibel limit at night. Yeah. Although you can hear the cars at night, the turbos especially, the road cars have a very low frequencies, but you can hear the cars. And especially in winter when there are less leaves on the trees, you can see lights in the distance going through the trees.
That's amazing. I can't imagine the company would get many noise complaints considering most of you locals, you're all Porsche or ex-Porsche anyway.
Yeah.
You can hear this in villages down the road. You can hear them testing loud cars, and the Lord Mayor says it's the Vysak music. It'll be a bad day when we don't hear any more noises coming from that direction. You know,
wow, how fantastic to have that link in your retirement. Still,
it is. It's
you're hearing that in the background. Yeah,
I think my wife's of the same opinion.
So Tony, you said you had a wing mirror in the garage. Have you got any other parts that we can make a car?
I've got a couple of suspension bits from a Carrera GT, but I don't have.
Oh, okay. Enough parts for us to put one together then.
No, and the wing mirror I have.
It'd be a hell of an eBay shop, that.
The wing mirror I have, because this is all done to fill street regulations. That's why it's so big. There has to be a certain amount of area you could see over the rear fender, and nothing could block. So there had to be that heat. There had to be that big. But it also, in an accident, had to move. So there was no way they could engineer a pivoting thing for this thing. So it had two bolts securing it in the wing, and they were milled, and they were if an impact happened, the mirror would break, the bolts would break.
Yeah,
but that was how they got over that problem, and that's the mirror I have in the garage. A test mirror,
brilliant.
It's fantastic to hear so many anecdotes. It's really nice to talk about race cars as well. I mean, Mark, I know that's like a huge passion of yours, so it's really nice to indulge in some of those memories today. All right, grand. Tony Hatter, Mark Sumter from Paragon Porsche, thank you like so much for your time today and talking all things GT1.
That's been fun. Thank you.
Great fun.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
That's fascinating, wasn't it? Fascinating.
Yes, absolutely. I love all the little snippets that came out. There's bits there that I don't know if anybody knows, like the windscreen part. Who'd have thought?
I definitely didn't know that.
964 speedster windscreen. But the funny bit is, you know, in the end, they didn't actually use the 964 speedster windscreen because they had to put the cutout in for the vent.
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
But I think, you know, thinking about, you know, where the company was at that time and what it was like, you know, to think, you know, you've got to, it's not a parts bin special, but you've got to, you know, you've got to work with
what you've got.
You know, with the time and the budget that you've got.
Yeah.
You know, you think with something that appears to be as sophisticated as that, that it's, you know, no expense spared, you know, massive budget project, but it's just not like that.
No. Yeah. And three seasons to try and win Le Mans as well. And they got there in the end.
Yeah,
absolutely fantastic. Yeah. Loved some of the aspects of it as well, in that so different, you know, the Mark 1, Mark 2 are very closely related, 993 cockpit, effectively, H-pattern gearbox. I think Mark said, you know, extremely busy cars as far as keeping it on the track. Mark 2 is pretty different, you know. There's pretty much not anything that was there on the Mark 1 and Mark 2. It's more of a pure sort of race car sequential gearbox rather than the H pattern. Intriguing to understand that. All I always thought, you know, GT1 was just different look each year. I didn't realize there was so much different stuff.
No, a lot of continuous development and evolution and then revolution even over the 3 years.
Intriguing.
Yeah, intriguing. And interesting to sort of be involved in a conversation, or listen to a conversation between Tony and Mark as well.
Yes.
You know, and their different experiences as an owner, driver and designer.
Yeah.
Really fascinating stuff.
It was good hearing Tony talking about some of the design features, like even down to the wing mirrors, where they've got some little grooves on them. And that's that was his like little design feature. I think he said that they took that through to the Carrera GT. So a lot of the stuff from the GT1 didn't make it to 911, but did make it through to Carrera GT. Because of, you know, it's the same people, I guess, doing the work on those two cars. So they used their learnings and took them through to the Carrera GT. So if there's a relationship of anything, it's through to the Carrera GT. I'm shame that Tony didn't know any more detail on the next hypercar.
Yeah.
I did ask, but yeah, he wasn't forthcoming, or he doesn't know.
No. Yeah. One of the two.
I had to ask the question.
You got to.
Yeah. Cool. I think that's great. GT1. Yeah.
Brilliant.
25 years ago. Crazy, really, that was 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I'll certainly look at that, you know, when I get to Festival of Speed.
Year,
you know, to the chance to see, you know, seen the 98 car at Festival of Speed before. I talked to Henry Catchpole once actually about his experience of driving it up the hill. But I'm sure it'll be there. I'll be able to look at it in a slightly different
light.
You know, with a bit more knowledge.
That's it.
So that'd be interesting.
Yeah, taking the design details, understand the having a look to see where the speedster wins. How does that fit in?
Exactly.
That's cool. Nice. Right. Shall we go on to, have you got a gem of the week this week?
I have got a gem of the week.
Not a GT1, is it?
It's not a GT1, unfortunately, but it is a Paragon car. So that seems appropriate for this week. And also because it's a car that I think would be superb for the trip that Lee's on at the moment. In fact, I think he's actually driven this very model of car. I think the first time he did the Norway, or the sort of going up to the Arctic Circle drive, which took him up through Norway, which he did for T911. And it's a really, really super example that Peregrine have got of a 991.2 Targa 4S. So it's not a GTS, so it gets around my centre lock anxiety, but it's got a really, it's got what I think is the best wheel design that they had on the 991.2, which I think is the RS Spider wheel.
Yeah.
So it's got that sort of BBS look about it.
Yeah.
And the car itself is GT silver, and the interior is, again, one that I particularly like, where the top of the dash and doors are black leather, and the seats and the rest of the door panels are Bordeaux red.
You've got that
sort of red wine red, not the horrible bright garnet red that they had. So, you know, that combination is, you know, the whole thing is just super classy.
Oh, I need to see this. Classic. I need to see it.
It's absolutely gorgeous. You know, it's PDK, it's got heated seats, you know, it's really super spec, but it's just such a beautiful looking car.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I was going off on that trip, with Lee, then that would be a car that I'd like to, you know, I'd like to be in. It's at Paragon 89995. It's a 2017 year car. It's just bloody gorgeous, I think.
You know what I'm like with a silver and a red.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a grey and a red. Yeah, that's right up my street, that is.
It's lovely. And the Targa, the modern Targa, is such a cool looking 911, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's it tends to be the one that, you know, if Mandy and I are out and we see one, it catches her eye. You know, lots of 911s pass her by unnoticed, but, you know, you see a Targa and she's like, oh, that's cool. I could go that.
Yeah. Nice. Good.
Yes. Yeah, so that's my gem of the week.
Yeah. Very good indeed. Very topical in all ways, I'd say.
Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. Good. We're going to skip Spread the Love this week. We'll be back with it next week. I've got a little update, some collective members. There was somebody that I forgot last week, and I do apologize, Pete. It's Pete Freeth, who's a privateer, and he is the owner of the yellow Boxster. What yellow was it? Speed Yellow.
Yeah.
Was at our little meet at the weekend.
Yeah, Lee's car of the meet.
It was indeed, wasn't it? Yeah. Pete and his other half, which I'm trying to remember, I think it could have been Miranda. I do apologise if I've got that wrong. Are driven from South Wales to be with us on Saturday. So great to meet you guys, and thank you for bringing the Speed Yellow along. A lot of people liked the look of that car.
Yeah.
What we do need to say is get out and drive it, because I think he is worried that it's got 59,000 miles on it and he's scared of hitting 60. I think just get on and get over that hump and get onto the next hump.
Absolutely. Get there quick. Absolutely. Yeah, there's been a lot of interest in the car, you know, following Mid-Engine and Mates, a lot of interest on the WhatsApp group. And Toby particularly was vociferous in his view that, just get on and drive
enjoy it.
Get into the 70,000s and keep on motoring.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Good. Right. Good to have you along, Pete. Next up is Jim Aris, who is a privateer, and he is in Essex. Good friends of the Essex Collective, including Geese, and also James. Maz from Garage Therapy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and James, yes. Yeah. So welcome, Jim. You currently drive a Gentian Blue 992 C4S, previously had a 991.1 C4S.
Yes. You've seen those pics have come up on the WhatsApp group, haven't they? A couple of really good-looking cars.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything else in his long text here? Yeah, went into great detail. Absolutely fantastic reading. If you haven't read it yet, Max, get a good reading.
I will.
Last up is Luke O'Neill, who's a privateer. He is close to us in Wimborne in Dorset. He's not got a 911 or any Porsche, should I say. He does not have a Porsche as yet, but as the want for a 997. He knows the guys down at Barnsport very well.
So I'm sure they'll be able to sort him out something at some point in the future. And he's just had a little baby, so it might be a few months until that happens. But he's currently tooling around in an RS4 estate. It's absolutely beautiful car. I've seen that around quite a bit. And he's also got a really nice woodwork company with some T6s, I think they are, that are slammed. One of them's a Dorker type pickup truck that slammed as well. It's cool as. So good to have you aboard, Luke. And
what colour's that?
I think it's dark blue.
Okay, maybe not the one I'm thinking of then. And his RS4, what generation is that? Is it a V8 one?
It's the V8 one, yeah. So that's the
B7.
B7, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, very nice. B7, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, absolute
997 would go perfectly alongside that.
It would, yeah. Absolutely agree with that.
As you say, Scotty at Bond Sport will help him go in the right direction on finding a nice 997. Indeed. I think that's a great idea, especially if he's just had a baby. You know, baby fit in the back of a 997 all the way up to probably 8 or 9 years old.
You're selling it well, selling it well.
Yeah, perfect. Couldn't be better.
Indeed. I need to say a sorry to Ed Simpson last week. It was an upgrade from rookie to privateer. I had my information all mixed up. So thank you, Ed, for your upgrade. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ed.
Yeah, thank you. I'm going to go hit a few reviews. We've had a lot of reviews of sort of during the break and of late. So I'm just going to read out a couple, if I may.
Yeah, go on. This,
I'm sure there's a real one that's going to make you cringe. Let's see if that's here. Right. First up is Paolo Schmitzer. A huge amount of knowledge and insights given in an easy listening yet informative manner with a touch of good humour thrown in. Lee, Andy, Max are genuinely passionate about the brand, and this comes across in every episode. Thank you, Paolo. Amazing.
Fine words, Paolo. Thank you.
Indeed. Next up, itbitdar_911. I don't know what your real name is, but you're in Australia. I think you might be one of our collectives, actually. I recognise.
Yes. With the new Riviera Blue PTS 997.
Ah, yes, it is. Yes.
GTS. Yes.
Yeah. I don't know your full name.
Yeah. Previous owner of an anthracite brown 991. Same as me. That was a couple of cars ago for him, which is how he and I first connected on Instagram. And apologies. Your name just escapes me, which is terribly embarrassing, seeing as we've been chatting for years about brown 911s. But yeah. This Riviera Blue 997 GTS that he's got is that's super cool.
Yeah, pucker. Yeah, the one and only in Australia, I think.
I think so. Yeah.
So his review, whoever you are, whatever your name is, sorry. One of the few things I really look forward to each week is the Nine Works podcast. I don't know how Lee, Max, and Andy manage to find new content that is interesting and relevant each week, but it's pure genius. Hoping one day I can come over to a DNHC mate. Neat. We look forward to it.
Bernie. It's Bernie.
Thank you, Bernie.
Thank you, Bernie. You're a good man.
Next up, this is Padraig O. Now, this is an Irish name. It's spelled L-A-O-I-G-H. How would you pronounce that?
L-A-O-I-G-H.
My dyslexia just does not let me even think about that.
God, that's tricky without seeing it in front of me.
So let's just say Padraig, OL. Thank you for your review. I've been a Porsche fan since I was a child with the obligatory red 911 poster on the wall and a hope that one day I might own one. Well, two things have happened. I bought my first Porsche in 2022 and I discovered the excellent Nine Works podcast. This podcast is hosted by Lee, Max and Andy. I really like the fact that it caters for all Porsche drivers and fans, from those on a budget to those who can afford the latest high-spec models or sought-after classics. The podcast is informative, funny, well-created, with excellent guests. I really can't think of any negatives to say about it. Lastly, but not least, it's a gateway to the Driven Not Hidden Collective, a community of like-minded individuals who make owning your Porsche so much
more enjoyable. Have a listen. You won't regret it. Patrick Lee. Ah, so it's actually Patrick Lee. I think he's done he's decoded the Irish for me. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you, Patrick. Again, very kind words. Thank you.
Absolutely. I think we've got a few more. I'm going to save those for another week.
I've had a bit of sort of ad hoc, odd little message, bits of feedback about the Spectrograt pod.
Yeah.
And how funny people have found it. Which is good to hear, because it was a funny record.
It was, wasn't it? Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I put up a post on NineWorks Radio this morning, which was the 993 that I was talking about in the episode, which is the yellow. I'm not sure which yellow outside. It's like a pastely yellow. And then it's got
summer
a green
yellow.
Is it summer yellow? I think you're right.
Yeah, that's what Dr. George commented on it, and he said summer yellow.
Summer yellow, yeah, with a green interior, which sounds like, whoa. And there's some really funny comments, actually. I like sprouts and I like custard, but not together. That was Rocket Monkey 76, which I think is Gareth that owns the summer yellow 914.
Oh,
he recently
picked
up from Romsey.
Got it.
That was good to hear about that at the weekend. Arsky says, wow, that's bold. Retro Classica says, beautiful. Yeah, there's George there saying summer yellow. What a colour. I wouldn't venture inside, though. Oh, a bit harsh. Paul Miller, proper spec on a 993. I wish my 964C2 had the LSD option. Brilliant. Yeah. Not the LSD diff, the LSD drug. It's proper.
I think it looks good. I don't think it looks in it because summer yellow is quite gentle. I think it's not, it doesn't jar in the way that I thought it would when you were talking about it. I suppose I was imagining speed yellow with that interior, and I thought, wow, you know, that's a bit much.
Yeah,
but actually, I think it's, you know, it is bold, but it's not as crazy as I thought.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think I'd rock it. It's definitely be a talking point, wouldn't it?
Without a doubt.
It's definitely not black on black, that's for sure.
Definitely not black on black.
Yeah. No, it was a great episode. I really enjoyed it. So, yeah, let us know what your spec regrets were as we post over this week on Instagram.
Share some pictures and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. Have you got anything else to bring to the party today, Max?
I have. It's slightly off topic, but I've got another new car.
No way.
Yeah. Yeah.
What have you got?
Yeah. I have sold my beloved, or our beloved, 2013 335i M Sport Touring BMW.
Oh, my word.
That has gone.
That must have been a wrench.
It really was, actually. It was as hard to let go as, maybe as hard to let go as the 997 was.
Yeah.
Which I think is reflective of the fact that both of those cars I owned for a long time and did many, many, many miles in them. Yeah. And I think so, you know, as Lee always says, it's about, you know, building up the memories in a car
absolutely.
As much as the actual sort of metal itself.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, you know, we've done a lot in that car, Mandy and I, but she used that car the most, and she was asking for something a bit more modern, a bit more economical, and physically a bit smaller.
Yes.
A bit shorter. So, you know, it had to go. So I sold it actually to a young lad, Liam O'Brien, who runs Quainton Garage, which is the little village garage we have where we live. And he's a big BMW fan, car guy, big BMW fan. And he serviced it and he had first refusal on it.
Yeah.
So I said to him, I said, look, Liam, it could be the time. Do you want it? And he said, he bit my hand off. So that was a very easy transaction. So that went to him. So I still see it round in the village. And we have bought a little Audi A1.
Oh, lovely. I like those. I think they're a good-looking little car. The original one, not the current one.
The original one, which I've always liked as well. Obviously, I can't buy a car that I don't like. You know, it just doesn't work for me. So, but I did kind of, although I was sad to lose the Beamer, I relished the challenge of having to seek out and decide and, you know, find an appropriate car to meet Mandy's criteria. So
what I've car always, guy doesn't?
Exactly. So I've always liked those A1s, particularly the, there's an S-line spec with a particular wheel, which again looks a bit like a mini light.
Yes.
You know, like those
like 997.
Like the 997. So I managed to find one with those wheels, and I actually ended up cinching it, you know, like on did the you? Adverts on the radio and on the TV. I cinched it. I did have to have two goes at it, because the first time I cinched it, they sent me one with a gearbox that didn't work properly.
Oh no.
So I was pretty unhappy about that, I have to admit. Yeah. But you know, the nature of the cinch process is you get to reject.
Cool.
So, you know, distance selling rules and all that sort of thing. So I rejected it, sent it back, they came and collected it. And I thought, well, I'll give it another go. So, you know, some folk might be saying, Max, how can you even consider buying a car without, you know, driving it, let alone seeing it? But a good friend of mine has cinched two cars very successfully, and he's very happy.
So I guess, actually, thinking about it, you've got, you know, you've got, you, what is it, 14 days, 7 days?
14 days, yeah, 14 days.
So you've got a 14-day test drive, really, of that car to see if it fits you, if there's any problems with it. Well, they'll probably come up in those 14 days, you know, any big problems that are there to start with. That's probably better actually than thinking about it, going for a test drive at a dealer.
Well,
okay.
And there doesn't have to be anything wrong with the car actually to reject it. You can decide after like that period that it's not, you know, it's not the right car for you.
Yeah.
And you can reject it. So, you know, it's actually not a bad, you know, I was really pissed off with the first one.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I thought that the guy that delivered it probably shouldn't have done, because the thing wouldn't go into sixth gear properly. Yeah. So,
did he actually drive it to you rather than it came
in? Yeah, so the bugger definitely knew about it.
Yeah,
but anyway,
that's not good, is it?
Put that bit to one side, and I think overall it's quite an interesting process.
Yeah.
And you know.
Yeah.
We've got the second one. Touch wood, it seems to work properly. We're going to take it on a bit of a road trip rather than taking the McCann, which is the natural car to take to Norfolk, which is what we're doing over Bank Holiday. I think we're actually going to pile everything into the A1.
Squish and, in.
You know,
and the three dogs.
And the three dogs, just to get to know it.
You'll get to know it for sure.
We'll definitely get to know it. So, so there we go. So that,
excellent.
That arrived yesterday. So, I've got a funky little A1.
You're all changing the Max Newman household.
So, it has been.
Yeah.
It has been. Well, I've got to keep up the momentum of the Nine Works, you know, garage rotation.
Yeah. Talking of cars, mine's actually, right now, as we talk, it's out being photographed by Rich Pierce for...
Oh, is it?
It's for sale. Yeah, so
The 993.
The 993 is out, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's to go on collecting cars, is it?
Maybe. Not sure yet.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought I'd get some nice photos done anyway with Rich, because he takes some fantastic photos.
He does.
Yeah. I thought it'd be good to have those, however I sell it, or maybe you don't.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, for any sort of listing, you know, you want to have some high quality pictures, don't you?
Yeah, pictures sell for sure.
Yeah.
So I drove it this morning, which is the first time I've driven it since probably a month, I guess. It's been in my neighbour's garage, hidden away. And it was quite, so different to the SC. The suspension is just outrageous on that thing. It's unreal, and it feels so light and modern compared to the SC. As far, you know, power steering, this is going around a corner just feels light. The brakes are very different, many differences. Intriguing. I wish I could keep both, but I can't.
What's the emotion then, do you think?
I adore the SC for that more vintage feel. Mm-hmm. I just feel that's what, now I'm over 50, that's what I feel like I need. You know, the 993 is a beast and so capable. I don't feel that I need
something that is that capable. Okay. I want something that's a bit more gentler in pace. Slows me down a little bit and, you know, take it a little bit easier. So, yeah, yes, it's good for me.
That's interesting. That's that kind of, you know, that echoes those thoughts that I had when I was out with Simon Jessup that day and I drove his 3.2.
Yeah, yeah.
And then got into his 993, you know, which is, you know, was a, you know, stock one. So not as, you know, not as serious as yours, but still the contrast between the two. I had similar sort of feelings.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. But I have to admit, when we were out on Saturday or after Mid-Engine and Mates, when we went for lunch, when you left the car park of the pub to go to Leeds House do the pod, you did. It really does suit you, that SC. You did look very cool. You look very, very coastal, very, very West Coast. It was all good. That's the car for you, without a doubt.
Yeah,
I thought.
Yeah, I do feel very comfortable in it. It's good. It's good. Excellent. Right, I think we should wrap it up there.
Yeah, I think so.
Good to see you, and great to hear from Mr. Hatter and Mr. Sumpter. Obviously, Leon as well, down at Charade. Hope Lee is all doing well out in
Europe.
When this goes out, I think he'll definitely be in the depths of Iceland. Where's he going?
Norway.
Norway. He'll be in the depths of Norway. So, Lee, hope the drive is going well, and look forward to seeing you next week.
Yeah, absolutely. Good stuff. Bye.
This episode was brought to you by our very kind Driven Not Hidden collective. If you would like to join the collective to get further access and rewards within the Nineworks community, you can do so at patreon.com/Nineworks. You can also support us by leaving a 5-star review on your favourite podcast app.